Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly. My name is Luke Clancy, and if you stay tuned for the next half an hour, you'll discover why comedian Maurice Gohan always hated going for walks anyway. Aislinn Kelleher explains the online equivalent of washing your hands properly. Composer Xenia Pastova-Bennett brings the music of the magnetic resonator piano, and in the end, we'll all meet up for a nice long soak in a gong bath. But to get us started this week, the latest epistle from comedian and writer Maurice Gohan. This time we asked Maurice to take a look at a recent BBC TV series, Yorkshire Walks, which is presented by the British artist and producer Shehnaz Gulzar. The series concept is as simple as it could be. A solo human talks us through her walks in the heart of England, holding a 360-degree camera on a selfie stick and surveyed from on high by a couple of drone cameras. You know, that kind of simple. In any case, this is Maurice Gohan's takeaway.
There's a show called Yorkshire Walks. It's about a woman going on walks around Yorkshire. Did I watch it? No. I fell asleep just hearing the title. It's the most boring thing I have ever heard. But it's 2020. You don't need to know a thing to talk about the thing. Making a TV show about someone walking is the height of disrespect to the viewing public.
My walk today starts in lovely Leyburn, along Shaw Ridge and Wood, then past the old smelt mill, through Preston under Scar, and then onwards to Castle Bolton.
It's outrageous. There's no skill to walking. We learn to do it at 2 years old. Anything a toddler can do isn't worthy of airtime. If you're going to show someone walking, there needs to at least be a risk of death involved. Everest walks. Maybe that would work. Although I'm actually quite against people climbing Everest. When I hear of people dying on the way up, I just think, good. You thought you were bigger than nature, than Mother Earth. The arrogance involved in that is astounding. Nature could wipe us all out at any moment. We are pawns in nature's game. We should be respecting nature and leaving it the hell alone. The people I feel bad for are the Sherpas. Losing a leg to try save some dope who works in finance, who wanted to feel alive for once in his shitty life. Taking cocaine and cheating on his wife wasn't enough of a thrill. He had to buy some hiking boots and book a flight to Nepal. I have nothing against people walking per se. I walk to get to places, like from A to B. I'm not just meandering around. There needs to be a purpose to the walk. And to get fresh air isn't a purpose, just so we're clear. Once again, we're in 2020. They're slicing DNA and making steak from cauliflower. There must be an app that just infuses fresh air into your home. If you go for a walk to get fresh air, you are living in the past. You wish Glenroe was back on the air and you probably voted no in the abortion referendum. Let go of the past and get with the times. There are 4 episodes to this series. That is 4 too many. How much walking does one woman need to do? It's like marathons. Running is just a more extreme type of walking. Run 1 mile. Repeat it 42 times. 42 times. Nothing is enjoyable when it's repeated again and again. It's like when people ask me what my dream job is. It does not exist. Anything I have to do for 5 days a week is not a dream. I love roller coasters. Love them. Nothing I enjoy more than going on a ride. If I had to do them for 8 hours straight, I would vomit. I'd be crying, begging for death. Anything you have to do over and over again loses any sort of enjoyment. The first time I heard a man's opinion, I enjoyed it.
Every woman lied when they came forward to hurt my campaign.
Now it's just white noise to me. Anything we have to do again and again makes us hate the thing. Take one walk, then you're good for the rest of your life. Do something else the next day. Value your life more than ever repeating anything.
That was Maurice Gohan there, who's taking really well to self-isolation. If you'd like to hear more of Maurice's previous Culture Files, have a look at the Culture File page on Spotify. A recent visitor to Dublin, remember those, was pianist and composer Zania Pastova-Bennett, who along with Ligeti Quartet came to launch a new album at this year's New Music Dublin Festival. With her, Pastova-Bennett brought the makings of a magnetic resonator piano, an electromagnetic add-on, which was fitted to the National Concert Hall's Steinway Grand piano for the show. The composer, along with piano wrangler Giulio Moro, plugged in the device for Culturefile's Louise McMahon to explain how it makes playing the piano more like playing the violin and how her music might just possibly help to deal with anxiety.
The Steinway D Concert Grand that we are looking at right now, so this is here in-house, but the rest of the mechanism was brought over in two suitcases from London and then installed very early this morning by Julia.
Setting up this piano takes about 3 hours, and it involves placing magnets on top of each string. These magnets are connected to some amplifier boards that live inside the piano, and these amplifier boards are the ones that take the signal and can feed it through the magnet with enough power to excite the string.
On a regular grand piano, of course, we're kind of fixed and trapped in a way to a grid. We have our chromatic keys, the black and white keys, and we can't really play in the cracks between them, even though we may wish to. Unlike a string player, they can do all sorts of fantastic pitch bends and glissandi. But on the magnetic resonator piano, I can do that, so I can show you now. So if I play, let's say, a black key, a B flat, by playing the key to the right and to the left, the white keys, I can create a sort of an oral illusion of a pitch bend. So it allows me to have that smooth kind of transition of sound, as opposed to just playing it as I would on a regular piano. And then some of the other exciting effects would be harmonic sweeps. So I'm able to activate the different components of each string. So, you know, when we play a note on a piano, it's not really just one sound we hear. If we listen very carefully, we'll hear all the kind of different components of it, the harmonic partials, the whole spectrum. So I'm able to bring these out, again, similar to what a string player can do, a violin player or a cellist. So, for example, if I take a low F natural on the magnetic resonator piano, if I play that key very gently, repeatedly, kind of tickle it, give it a little tickle, it will give me the different harmonics. So that's a very beautiful evocative sound, and I use that quite a lot in my music. Finally, another effect that we can do, which is really exciting, is we can crescendo or grow a note from absolutely nothing. And again, that's something we cannot do on a real piano. We're kind of bound by principles of attack and decay. If I play a chord, for instance, on a regular piano, it starts to decay immediately after I strike it, and there's really nothing I can do. I mean, I can maybe shape that decay with pedals, but I can't really extend it beyond its natural duration. But with this mechanism, what I can do is I can fade it in and then grow the sound. And again, that's really exciting for a pianist who's so used to doing things a certain way and then discovering this amazing stuff. It's just so wonderful. the project grew very organically, very naturally, just through improvising with the instrument. And I started coming up with kind of etudes and sketches for pieces just to help me come to terms with what I can do with this amazing mechanism. And then gradually these pieces of music appeared and kind of grew by themselves.
When you were playing, it was soothing. And then when the Ligeti Quartet chimed in, it became anxious and then back to soothing. And I was wondering if you have a musical relationship with anxiety.
What an amazing question. That's really interesting because I am very, very interested in anxiety and in performance anxiety and also generalized anxiety. And as another hat that I wear, I'm also a trained yoga teacher and I deliver workshops on what I call befriending anxiety, where we use simple movement, breath, and focus exercises to kind of understand and start coming to terms with those feelings and sensations. I think indirectly, I do meditate. I have a daily meditation practice. And I suppose, I mean, I don't want to make any grand claims, but I think, of course, it does kind of filter through what I do in terms of my life and the music I make. So perhaps there are glimpses of calm and also the kinds of sounds that this amazing instrument can produce, these sustained, beautiful kind of shimmering sounds. They can be very evocative and very calming, but also at the same time, it can be very powerful. So maybe that also feeds into this idea of anxiety, calm, energy, soothing, and changing kind of shimmering soundscapes.
Zania Pastova-Bennett there talking to Louise McMahon. The album Atomic Legacies is officially released on April 6th and is available for download from Diatribe Records and via Bandcamp. And if you've never bought any music from Bandcamp.com, now is a great time to start. That way, lockdown musicians are far more likely to quickly feel the benefit than when you stream their music. Just a thought. Now, if you're in an accept-all-cookies frame of mind these days, what do you think about making delicious white strawberries by dipping them in bleach? How about melting gummy bears to make jelly? These and many other household hacks have been gaining plays and likes online. But are they really helpful hints or only useful for harvesting the clicks of the inexperienced? Our tech correspondent Aisling Kelleher talked to me from her desk at Virginia Tech about why a bit of information hygiene might be as important right now as a strong hand-washing game. People often go to the internet and they talk about YouTube as this amazing resource where you can really, and you can, find out how to do anything. But with that kind of great encyclopedic facility, you also have started to get people who are putting up information that is, I guess it's the fake news of the DIY world, showing you how to do things, but they're not actually correct.
Yeah, this is quite worrying maybe or disturbing. I mean, we've started out where a lot of like chefs or people who are professional designers were, you know, cultivating a following online, using YouTube to, you know, teach examples from their books and put together these fairly nicely crafted videos. And then we start seeing this phenomenon maybe in the last couple of years of those, you know, singular overhead shots with kind of jaunty music, maybe no narration, of showing you in a procedural way how to go through, like, in many ways, they're like hacks, they call them, like that you would never have thought of this. This is such a cool and quick thing to do. So not necessarily following particular recipes or the type of sequential instructions that you might get on a website like Instructables, but instead it's just like, here's this quickly edited video that is like a little snack, right? So you can see in maybe 30 seconds or 45 seconds, you're like, oh, they can go from that to that. What's complicating in this is that there seems to be a phenomenon of people putting together like these huge content farms or just churning out these videos. And they're leaving out some important steps, or if not completely faking the ending altogether, or even worse, coming up with some really, really bad and potentially dangerous ideas that when others who are either food science experts or people who are interested in DIY actually try to put together themselves, they realize that this could have like a really disturbing outcome. So I think there was a phenomenon for a while, and which I also participated in, of trying to do like Martha Stewart's dyed Easter eggs, and then you would take a picture of that and then be like, and here's Martha's and here's my fail. Right? And so it's like a Pinterest fail, and that seemed kind of funny. But these particular videos seem like, well, of course they're doomed to fail because they're faked and they have some really poor ideas. Like, a lot of them seem to involve bleach. There's a bunch of like really terrible, both craft ones and baking ones. And a lot of, there's a wonderful food scientist named Anne Reardon, Australian woman, and she has her own channel showing you how to make really great recipes. And also, because she is a food scientist and became very worried and concerned and wanted to debunk these types of things and work out how you could do them. And partly she'd kind of tear these apart, but she's also done follow-up investigative work trying to ask the companies that are producing these, like, what, like, there's absolutely no relationship between the outcome in the videos that they're creating and actual reality. One of the ones that I was like, oh, come on, is the idea that you take an uncooked ear of corn and put it in a brown bag, and then you put it in the microwave, and out comes a warmed up corn and apparently popcorn. And this is what their video shows. And that's like clearly impossible. But they're putting this out there as like, this is a wonderful way to make popcorn. And I don't know whether you're trying to teach a child that, but that's pretty bad science. And it also doesn't have any disclaimers on it. So that one is maybe very obvious, but other ones are, if you get a glass of bleach and drop a strawberry into it, and when you take the strawberry back out, it'll be white. And you're like, well, yeah, but you, strawberries are for eating, and the last thing you want is for anybody, child or adult, to eat a strawberry that's been dipped in bleach.
Who are making these kind of videos, and why?
Yeah, the why is interesting. I mean, I think there's also a bunch of videos that are just like scaremongering videos about this is in children's food and this is in rice, and this is just pure clickbait. You know, it's just going to attract lots and lots of eyes. So you start seeing a viral video about, you know, these are like fearful things are in food, and within over a weekend it's shared 40 million times. And even no matter how quick scientists or anybody really comes out and tries to debunk it, it's not going to get that same virality and kind of like spread and distribution all around the world that, you know, a less kind of breathless, less bombastic video is going to put together. So there are companies in LA that are putting these together targeted towards, we're really trying to get teenagers maybe interested in crafts or have these huge followings. Like one is called Blossom, made by content companies. These are not like fly-by-night kind of things. These are things that do a lot of branding, for example, for big clients, like soft drink companies and others. So these are like, well, they seem like legitimate companies that are also content farms generating huge followings, which, you know, on platforms like Facebook will generate a lot of advertising dollars.
And on YouTube as well. What this addresses is kind of the shortcomings of the algorithm, in that the algorithm is assessing content, basically, what the video is about, rather than the quality of the information in it.
It is, and maybe that's purposeful, you know, because it's just folks who also invent or who are creating this content, they realize that people are consuming this in really small amounts, maybe particularly if you're looking at content on your phone and flicking through Instagram or flicking through Facebook. These are videos that you can look at very, very quickly. If you think it seems almost that you would have sat down to watch Delia Smith or, you know, any of these other cooking shows, that would have sat there for an hour waiting to see one particular roast beef dinner be constructed, when through this type of content you can get from A to B in 10 seconds and be like, I didn't know, I just had to microwave it in polyethylene and I'd have been grand, you know. And also the sense of like, this is supposed to be about hacks, or that it's about ingenuity and you're smarter if you know this. But these things just are not based on science, but much more rather on like just that little headline alone, or that little first click will get people really interested in clicking on it. And I think slowly people will get smarter, the same way that you see, you know, this one trick to do with your like your gut biomes will solve this, the types of kind of very bizarre ads that you see as part of sponsored content on online newspapers, for example. I think we've learned that's clearly all garbage, and whether or not we can begin to ascertain or who is responsible if somebody copies something that they see on one of these videos and does ingest bleach or does, you know, do something that is going to send scalding hot caramel liquid all around your room, who ultimately is responsible? Is it the content creator or the platform that it's disseminated on or the algorithms that artificially surface this fake news? The same way with the fake news. It's like, it's just, if it's too good to be true, it's probably too good to be true, and don't do that.
Professor Aisling Kelleher there, talking to me from her well-wiped desk at Virginia Tech about DIY disinformation. And finally, this week, time for that nice hot gong bath. Though, as the leaders of the bath, Lisa and Brian of Soundhenge, Ireland, make sure to point out, there's no need to take off any clothes and nobody gets wet. Before the new dispensation, Lisa and Brian held gong baths both outdoors and indoors at festivals and halls around Ireland. Culturefile brought its towel to one of their Dublin visits and, in a manner that would now amount to recklessness, lay down with 30-odd other souls in a candle-lit, plant-filled room and had a good sonic soak. And stay tuned afterwards for instructions on having your own social distance gong bath.
I'm Lisa Dunn. I'm from Dublin, but I live in Belfast.
I'm Brian Cunning. I'm from Port Stewart, but I live in Belfast.
They're incredible instruments. I am completely drawn to both the look and the sound of them ever since I first encountered them. I have a couple of different types of gongs here. Well, five. This top one here is a symphonic gong. It's made by a company in Germany called Peisty, and it's the type of gongs that is often used in orchestras. This one underneath is a Chinese wind gong. It's a typical Chinese gong. This is much thicker metal. These gongs are made out of a particular type of metal that already comes in a sheet, whereas this is cast and this is beaten and hammered into shape. So this is the original old-fashioned gong-making technique. This is a bit more German engineering, as they do very, very well. So it's the gong that I would play most. This is another German gong made by Peisty. This is called a Venus gong. And Peisty have a range of planetary gongs, which are all, they're tuned to the orbital frequencies of the planets in our solar system. I like the sound of Venus. It's a nice, deep, soothing sound. It's also very feminine. So I chose it for the sound, yeah. When I play the gongs during the sound bath, if I leave them to hang straight afterwards, they'll still be vibrating for up to an hour after I stop playing. The big gongs, they can be. The vibrations will still be travelling, but they're inaudible at that point. But there still are vibrations there. And this gong is a Chinese sun gong.
It's a stripy gong.
So part of it has been lathed and part of it hasn't. And this was my very first gong.
When together?
2011. So this was my very first gong, and as you can see, they multiply and they grow.
I see also a big conch shell you have going on there.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Some glass pyramids.
Yes, crystal singing pyramids, a quartz crystal singing bowl, some chimes, a Native American flute. I probably won't get a chance to play all of the instruments. We'll see how it goes and I'll pick whatever. We usually bring everything, but we don't always play it all.
You've got a lot of bowls of different sizes,
yes,
laid out on a batik.
Bronze bowls, yes. They're made from bronze. They come from the Himalayan region, Tibet, Nepal, China, India. So that's striking them. And then you can also play them with the wand, stroking them like this around the side. Thank you. there isn't anywhere in Ireland, unfortunately, that you can go and try them out and buy them. So this was bought on the internet.
And how do you do that? Do you look at their pictures or do people describe their qualities?
There will be a description, but good websites will have a sound clip. And in 2013, I went on my first training course. And then I got to play a lot of different gongs from different manufacturers all over the world, from different areas in the world. It's called a gong bath because you're bathed in the vibration and sound. There's no water, there's no taking clothes off. You simply had to lie down and let the vibrations and the waves of sound wash over you. The sound that they produce is a sound that you not only hear, but you feel. The vibrations are so strong that you will feel them throughout all of your body, and it allows the body to slip into a very relaxed state, a very deep state of relaxation. The sound can also carry the mind, and so can bring you into a deep state of meditation. You may experience shamanic type journeying, sense of levitation, out of body experience. You may just experience peace and inner stillness. Everybody will have a different experience during a gong bath. The drumming tends to carry people into a sort of journey type state. Then I will allow the gongs take over. Basically, it's as soon as I start to play, the gongs decide what's going to happen next. I don't make any grand claims to be a healer. I think that's a big claim to make. But what this type of experience does is bring you to a place where your body comes to a place of self-healing. When you're completely relaxed, when your body will regenerate and rejuvenate. If you play a recording, today's recording again, it'll possibly take you back to some of the same experiences that you've had, but I think it's different live. It's definitely different live. You've got the instruments close up. You can feel the vibrations. It's certainly effective on a recording. I listen to recordings myself at home, going to bed sometimes at night, singing bowl recordings or gong recordings, but live is definitely better. It's an instrument that draws the mind and can stop thought in its tracks.
Lisa and Brian of Soundhenge, Ireland there, who had their most recent full moon sound bath in Belfast earlier this month. And if you'd like to try a socially distanced gong bath, we've just tweeted a link to a recording of the bath you just heard, but without the chatter. Look for Culturefile Pod on Twitter. Download, press play, and lie quietly on the floor for a few minutes. And why not tell us how you get on too? You can contact us at CulturefilePod on Twitter or email us via culture@rte.ie. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll all be back with more audio prescriptions next Friday at 7 here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.